I'm Jason.
This is Mike.
You're listening to Story Jammers, a podcast about role-playing games. Today, the Story Jammers journey.
Hi, I'm Ryan Macklin from Master Plan. You can check out some fine podcasts like the one you're listening to right now at rpgpodcast.com.
So, are you a big Joseph Campbell fan?
I'm familiar with some of his stuff.
The Hero's Journey?
Yeah.
So, I think this has been covered on a lot of RPG podcasts, especially if you listen to the Roundtable, which was all about applying the Hero's Journey to role-playing games, and I loved that podcast. I loved it a lot. I'm so sad that that doesn't exist anymore, but I still get to hear Mick Bradley on Canon Puncture, which is also an awesome podcast. And like I mentioned in the last episode, their episode on story games is really what started to draw me into the independent story games a lot. Anyway, the basic Hero's Journey has three basic parts, and I think that at least what I've heard on RPG podcasts that have dealt with the Hero's Journey, they've kind of missed the point. Like, they'll criticize the Hero's Journey as not every story fits this mold, or because you don't want to follow it slavishly. But the Hero's Journey is really, using the Hero's Journey to write a story is really kind of mix and match kind of endeavor, because each of those three sections has so many different things that can or cannot happen. Like, the reluctant initiation isn't necessary for it to be a hero's journey. That's only one possible way that the initiation phase can take place.
Wait, are you saying it's possible to have an RPG where the hero's village isn't destroyed and or his mentor doesn't die?
Right.
You're totally messing with me, man.
And it's still the hero's journey.
It's funny, I recently picked up a copy of Baldur's Gate because I had played it when it originally came out. And when they introduced Goriad, I was just thinking, he might as well just be carrying a sign around saying, please kill me. Spoiler alert, by the way, for anyone who wasn't able to figure that out in the first 5 seconds.
But the basic structure of the hero's journey, when you cut away all the different possible formations of that, you have initiation, you have the journey itself, and you have the return. And right. These can go in different ways. Like we just said, the mentor can die, or maybe he doesn't die. I mean, there has to be some way in which the mentor is sidelined so that the hero can rise,
yeah,
if there's a mentor at all. There doesn't need to be a mentor.
Well, that's the main thing, is just there needs to be a motivation pushing the hero to go off on his own, which is why, you know, the village is always burned to the ground, because we can't have it so comfortable that he doesn't want to leave. You know, you gotta kick him out the door and say, get out there and start questing.
And you don't need to have a reluctant call to adventure. You can, it can be reluctant, it can be fully embraced, it can be sought after. The main thing is that there's a separation from your normal life. There's this grand journey you go on, and then there's going back home. You're a reintegration into the normal world.
Right.
And these are all
the part that usually gets cut out.
Yeah, very often. That's the part that we leave behind. And I think that's kind of telling about where our values are, that we cut that off.
Yeah.
Because Campbell's three parts of the heroic journey relate to Arnold van Gennep's idea of rites of passage that he wrote about in the early 1900s. You probably have not heard of Arnold van Gennep.
I have not.
He's a much less well-known character, and mostly known in anthropological circles, because he was writing about rites of passage in various societies. And he said that rites of passage have three stages: preliminal, liminal, and postliminal. Liminal meaning on the outside, in an in-between state, where you're neither one thing nor the other. And this is important if you're having a rite of passage, because there's, say you have a rite of passage into adulthood. You start off as a child, you know, and in the ritual itself, you are in this middle ground where you're neither child nor adult. And when it's over, you emerge as an adult. So think of like a wedding, a modern wedding. You have several preliminal ceremonies, which are saying goodbye to your old life. You have the bachelor party for the groom. You have the wedding shower for the bride. You have the whole tradition where the groom can't see the bride that day. You know, this kind of all these things that are intended to separate you and say goodbye to your old life.
Right.
Right. Then you have the wedding itself. And then you have the reception, which is the post-liminal ceremony, where you're reintegrating back into normal society. You invite all of your family. The couple is presented as a new couple. They're presented to, and there's this big feast to kind of seal everything together and to reintegrate what this new couple that's been formed. And these are exactly the same stages in Joseph Campbell's monomyth. The first, there's the initiation or call to adventure where the hero is separated from the normal state of affairs. There's the journey that he goes on to gain this boon. And then there's the return where he brings the boon back to the community.
I have always compared marriage to venturing into Mordor. So I think that's a good comparison.
All of our major rites of passage are like this.
I know.
Wedding is probably the best. Is probably the best known example that we have the most things built up around.
Yeah.
But we could look at like First Holy Communion for Catholic kids, and look at the same preliminal, liminal, and postliminal.
Yeah.
Sections there. And so that's why the heroic story resonates, is because it's ultimately all of our stories. It's the story of every person who goes through a change in their life. And there's this boon, the Holy Grail, the Golden Fleece, whatever the boon may be, something that you ventured out and brought back to the community so that you are enriched by gaining it, but also the community that you're in is enriched by the fact that you went on this journey and went through this transformation and had this experience.
Yeah, that's what I find interesting about how often we seem to cut out the hero's return part of the journey, because it's kind of like saying, I got the boon, screw you guys, I'm keeping it for myself.
Yeah, it emphasizes our individualist philosophy that ultimately it's about your own enlightenment, your own self-discovery, things that you attain for yourself. And I find it somewhat unfulfilling if that's all there is.
Yeah, because in Campbell's version of the heroic journey, you're supposed to be bringing a boon back to the community where it came from.
Because as it is, when you leave off at the achieving the boon, you're still off there in the liminal state. You're cut off from your community. You're rootless. You may have gotten the Holy Grail, but you're kind of a pathetic creature, because you have no community to integrate you.
But then from a storytelling standpoint, I think the issue is, how do you make the hero's return interesting?
Right.
Which has been done a few times, but it's difficult, because usually you've reached the climax by then and you're kind of winding down.
Shoot, the Odyssey starts with the climax is all about the return.
The Odyssey is entirely the hero's return.
Right.
So that's one, but...
I mean, the Iliad was the first two stages, and the Odyssey was the last.
Well, even there, you notice the Odyssey is just a completely separate story.
Yeah.
That even though it starts from where the Iliad ended,
it's
a different story. So if you were to tell one story, the hero's return poses a problem from, okay, you had this big climax where he got the boon. How do you keep it interesting through that third stage?
I think Tolkien did a good job of it with the Scouring of the Shire. I always liked the Scouring of the Shire.
That's probably one of the better ones, but even that is kind of this thing where the ring has already been destroyed. And then you just have Sauron or Saruman off doing his own thing, just completely out of left field, just took over the Shire. It's like, what is this?
Well, there's an anthropologist that I really love called Tim Ingold. The reason I love his work is that he's really taken the time to think about the full cognitive and philosophical implications of what some of the animist views of the world would really mean. If you take animism seriously, what does it look like? What's the world feel like then? And one of the things he does is he takes Cartesian dualism and really follows a renunciation of Cartesian dualism to its ultimate conclusions. If you say that the world is not two things, what's that really mean? And he gets down to things like genotype and phenotype, the concept of culture. All of these things are ultimately rooted in our Cartesian dualism, which science based on Cartesian assumptions has itself renounced.
Yeah.
There was another anthropologist named Rain Willerslev who went and did some field work with the Yukigirs in Russia. And he was a student of Tim Ingold's. And his ethnography called Soul Hunters was really integrating Tim Ingold's work and applying it on a practical level. So I really enjoyed his work. But I bring it up here because he talks about the way that the Yukigirs hunt. And the Yukigirs don't have a real big storytelling tradition. They don't have a lot of legends and myths. But storytelling does play a big part in their culture. The Yuga Gears believe that, like many animist people, that hunting is not a violent act. That hunting is taking something that the animal offers. Now, to the Yuga Gears, they see this as something involved with sexuality and seduction. That they make themselves appear more like the animal, and the animal...
Okay, that's a little messed up.
Look at a Yuga Gear hunter dressed up in an elk suit, and it's not immediately obvious that this is a human. The whole, it smells like an elk, it sounds like an elk, it moves
like
an elk.
It's like the Bugs Bunny cartoon where he dresses up as the female Tasmanian devil.
A little bit, yeah. But there's more to it than just that. Because he doesn't look like a human. He doesn't smell like a human. He doesn't move like a human. He moves, he smells, he sounds like an elk, almost. And yet there's something distinctly un-elk-like about him, too. So this creature is in this liminal state where it's not exactly human anymore, but it's not elk either. The hunter sees the elk seeing him, and this hall of mirrors that Rain Willer's Lev talks about, where it's the creatures perceiving them being perceived.
He's playing a druid.
in a lot of ways. But the experience that they have is of the elk trying to draw them away into the animal world forever. They're seducing the elk into giving itself up. And then at the moment when the elk gives itself up, they take what the elk offers. And this, to the Yuga Gear, they say that this presents a existential threat. Because in order to hunt this way, they say that you have to separate yourself from the human community for several days. Because the smell of children and women sticks to you. You have to separate yourself out so that you'll lose your smell for several days. You have to not refrain from human speech. You know, you enter this world where you're shedding your humanness to enter this liminal world. So there's this initiation stage. And then there's this liminal journey where you're going out to gather the boon being the meat that you're, the animal that you're going to bring home, the gift of its own life and its own flesh. It's the bones and the skin and the meat that you're going to bring back to your family. And then there's a post-liminal phase where you're coming back to the human community and you're trying to reintegrate. And there's a story that sounds a lot like stories about Sasquatch or Bigfoot, especially if you read the short story In the Abode of the Snows, where it's about a guy who journeys up into the Himalayas and slowly forgets his humanity and becomes a Yeti in his pursuit of the Yeti. And there's this existential threat that going into this liminal state, you may forget that you're human and never come back. When you do come back with the animal, that's when the storytelling comes in, telling the story of how you took the animal. These are very straightforward stories, not a lot of flowery language or anything, but just using human language again and recounting the story and making sense of everything that happened to you, taking the essentially chaotic experience of the hunt and ordering it by human logic is the act that brings you back into humanity. And it made me think that Arnold van Gennep's Rites of Passage and ultimately Campbell's Hero's Journey stem from this experience, this animistic experience of hunting, where you're entering this liminal state of something human and yet not human at the same time, and then returning to your humanity afterwards.
So how does this all relate to role-playing games again?
Well, story jamming is, I think, follows much the same pattern, where we come in, we're coming from the normal world, you know? We've got our normal cares and worries, you're tired from your day at work, or you know, you didn't get enough sleep the night before, you haven't eaten, whatever your mundane cares may be. And the first part of story jamming is warming up. You know, we have warm-up games that may be integrated into the story, they may be separate standing, just warm-up exercises. We talked a little bit about warm-up games in our episode on fluency play. Mostly we talked about how warm-up games aren't fluency play. Our next episode we'll talk about warm-up games.
Yeah, that can be part of it.
They can be. But they're not exactly the same. They can overlap, but they're not the same. In our next episode we'll talk about warm-up games and how to use those, and we'll get down to some specifics with that. But that's your first phase. You're separating yourself from your normal experience. You come in with in your normal state of mind, and the warm-up games are starting to pull you into a different state of mind. So that's the preliminary phase of the story jam. Then we have the major part, the part that takes up the most time of story jamming, which is the story jam itself. And there, we're hunting story. You know, there's the story's there. The story's in that place and time.
Be very, very quiet.
The story already exists, and we're trying to find it. We're trying to hunt that story down and find out what that story is, and we're doing it all together. We're not making up the story. We're finding the story that's already there.
It's like Michelangelo type stuff.
Yeah, frankly. And you'll notice that a lot of the great artists have said similar things, that the story was already there and they just went out and found it. That's the experience that people have of creativity, that the story is there. And I think that goes back to what we were saying in the last episode about creativity coming from our relationship with the world around us. The story is already there, embedded in the world around us. We just have to find it. And it's that relationship that allows us to find it.
Yeah, well, I know there have been a few times where we really got into a flow with some of the other people at the table. And it really does make a much better gaming experience when you can build that kind of give and take between the players.
Mm-hmm. And then finally, when we've found the story, we end the story jam, we have a wrap-up phase where, you know, a cool down where we try to bring back what it is that we found in that story and bring it back to our normal life again. I don't know too many games that do this, and even in story jamming, the attempts are kind of embryonic, but probably the best example in a well-known game would be Mouse Guard, where at the end of each session, you go through your questions about your beliefs. Did you play your belief? How well did you do? And we have this review of the game and what happened. And we wrap up, and we have tied it. In Mouse Guard, it's tied up into the reward system, which I think is a great way to handle it and really weave it into the game. But just having some time to... I mean, I think this happens informally in D&D most of the time.
I think that happens in most games that you play is when you get to the end. You know, people, they don't run for the door. You know, they hang out. Mm-hmm. We talk about what happened during that session. We talk about which encounters we liked, what we didn't like, what we thought was funny.
Mm-hmm. We take the chaos of the experience and order it by the human logic of narrative and recollection.
So, I mean, it's not like really a formal thing,
right.
But, you know.
Right. And this is the experience of story jamming, and I think it follows that same pattern of the preliminal, the liminal, and the post-liminal. And I think that we can benefit from recognizing those stages and trying to build up more things that address those stages. Like we said, we usually have a informal post-liminal phase in our games anyway. If we could formalize that, we might be able to get more out of it. I think that we get more out of it in Mouse Guard because of the formal the rules that address
it.
Do
we?
I think so.
Well, I mean, we get more of it in Mouse Guard because we get stuff for it in Mouse Guard.
Well, I think that's what I mean. Because it's formalized, you get something from it. So it makes you stay at the table and review.
But, you know, I don't want to have to stay after the game to write a book report.
No, not a book report, but just taking some time to kind of allow what you've just done to really set in. And if you can make it fun in and of itself, that's good too.
Yeah.
In fact, since we're coming together to have fun, you probably need to make this something that's fun.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the most important part is, you know, like I said, shouldn't it be a chore? Like,
yeah.
Okay, now we're going to sit down and have our discussion group.
Right.
You know, and like I said, most games, it kind of occurs naturally just because people, you know, they want to talk about it. They want
right.
to digest what they've just been doing for 4 or more hours.
Yeah. And like I said in the last episode, story jamming is a lot about understanding the energy at the table and trying to control and tap into that energy. And understanding this kind of progression, I think, is important for that because you understand how the energy builds up, how it's used, and then how it dissipates. And that means that once we have established that, we can look at each phase in turn and look at what are the techniques that we need to have and what techniques do we need to use and what do we need to address in each phase to achieve those things.
So basically, for a good story jamming game, you want to start by destroying the player's village and killing their mentor. Then you play the game, and then you award troth points or
right.
embodiment points.
Not exactly.
No.
But we'll be.
But that's the gist.
No, not
okay.
even a little bit. So over the next few episodes, we'll be taking each of those phases in turn and talking about what are the techniques that address the concerns of that phase, and how do you make those the goals of each phase work out well. I think, and it, that's why I think that understanding the story jammer's journey in total is kind of important, because that helps you break it down into manageable size and into manageable bits.
So this is the syllabus outline.
Yeah. Yeah, this is kind of the syllabus. And it also, I think, is important because it points out why these things resonate with us as human beings, because it calls back to the most essential human experience. So this is the golden age of my gaming. I have never had better gaming than I have now.
Yeah, and you recently started up a werewolf game.
Yep.
And you were telling me about some of the stuff you are doing in there that I thought was pretty cool. So if you want to talk about that.
Yeah, one of the things that makes this the greatest time for me in gaming ever is this werewolf game that I've been wanting to play this werewolf game for a long time. Werewolf the Forsaken, part of the New World of Darkness, published by White Wolf. I love the setting. I love the setting so much that I'll even put up with their crappy system. I did make some hacks, though, because I just couldn't stand some parts and I needed to change them. One thing was the experience system. Now, World of Darkness has a pretty low experience system in terms of the count. So at the end of each session, you might get 3 or 5 XP for what you did. And, you know, 5 XP, I think, is an advance. You know, it takes 3 XP to get a new skill, things like this. So we're talking...
Yeah, not like Dungeons & Dragons, where next level up at 350,000 XP.
Exactly. It's 1,000 points to level 1 and so forth. Yeah. I kind of cobbled together a new experience system that takes part from the quest idea in 4E and part from Primetime Adventures. I wanted this to be a player-driven game, and that's where the quest came in. So we have a bunch of index cards that we throw around, and anybody can pick up an index card and write a mission objective on it. You write an objective for what you want to accomplish in this mission. And I have veto authority in case people want to abuse this and say, go to the bathroom, and I get 1 XP because I went to the bathroom. You know, but that's really all I use that veto for, is making sure that people aren't gaming the system.
That could totally be a quest. Okay, you go out of a quest to go to the bathroom. It's, as GM, I declare that it's worth 0.00000001 XP.
Well, no, every mission is 1 XP.
There's no fractions.
No fractions. There's not even 2 XP. Every mission is 1 XP.
Okay.
So, and the other parts, that there's a renown in Werewolf, where there's like this, there's 5 types of renown, and you know, you kind of emanate this renown through the spirit world. So you can either write pack on the mission statement, in which case it's a mission for the whole pack, and everybody gets 1 XP when you accomplish that mission. Or you can write the name of an individual, and it's that individual's mission. And if you accomplish that, that individual gets XP. If you have an individual, you can also mark a type of renown on it, and finishing that mission will also get you 1 point of that type of renown. So the group, the writing pack, will get you more XP because there's 5 people in the pack. That means there's 5 XP being doled out in total. Assigning to yourself only gets 1 XP, and it's kind of selfish, but you also get, it's also the only way to get renown. So there's kind of that tension introduced. Do you want to give it to everybody, or do you want it to be something that you are going to do all by yourself? So if you're accomplishing 2 or 3 missions in a game, you're going to get 3 XP a game, potentially. Maybe 2 if there's individual quests. And that's a little bit on the skimpy side for World of Darkness. But built on top of that is something I stole from Primetime Adventures. Now, Primetime Adventures is built to kind of emulate a TV series. So you start off by establishing your character arc. So let's say you have a 5-episode series, right? So you're going to have 1 3, 2 2s, and 2 1s, and you can apportion those across those 5 episodes any way you want. Your 3 is going to be your spotlight episode. That is the episode all about you. And where you have 1s, you're a supporting character at best. The 2s, you're somewhere in between the 2 extremes. And that kind of fits what you see in a lot of serial television, you
right,
know?
Yeah.
Well, we kind of did the same thing. In New World Darkness, there's there's the chronicle, which is the campaign, and there's the chapter, which is the nightly session. Then they have this thing in between called a story, which can be one chapter, it can be several chapters. And I went ahead and formalized that as six. There's six chapters in a story. So at this beginning of a story, okay, you have a three, you have two twos, and you have three ones. Apportion them as you see fit. Your three is your spotlight. Your two is in between. Your one, you're a supporting character. And that helps me write up what the game's going to be, because I kind of write my part of it to aim at whoever is the spotlight character. And at the end of the game, that's your base XP. If it's your three, you get 3 XP right off the bat. If you accomplished 3 missions and it's your spotlight, you got 6 XP out of that, which is pretty good. If it's not your night, you have a 1 and you accomplished 2 missions, you get 3 XP out of it. So it's in the right range to keep everything still running properly, at least as far as I understand the system. And that's one of the other things, that there's not a lot of ways to build balanced encounters. I found out after the fact that the cop in the back of the book is actually kind of a composite super cop. Like, if you want to have an investigative cop versus a cop who's good with guns, they kind of gave him good stats at everything and said, and expected you to tone down the parts that you didn't want this particular cop to be good at.
Oh, I see. So it's not just the entire police force is RoboCop.
Right. Yeah, you're supposed to tone down parts, but I didn't know this going in. There's no note in the book to say this. So, yeah, they were up against super cops, and I was wondering why a werewolf was having so much trouble against two police officers.
This is the problem with police brutality.
Right. They beat up werewolves.
Yes.
I also used willpower to kind of hack in aspects like in Fate. So in Fate, you have aspects, and you can compel them. And you get a fate point if you accept the compel, and then you lose a fate point if you resist. And this is really good for temptations. And some games, like your average D&D game, you don't really need a lot of that because it's about big, strong heroes going into the dungeon. But White Wolf games, World of Darkness games, are all about temptation, you know? And the humanity mechanic, the morality mechanic, is kind of interesting in that regard, where, you know, you commit sins and it drops you lower and lower. But there's not much to really tempt a character to go do something foolish. Well, I decided to use willpower for that. I'll throw out temptations. And if you accept, you get a point of willpower. And if you want to resist, it's going to cost you a point of willpower to resist. So nice. Just like the fate, you'll take the compel, even if you know it's stupid, in order to get that fate point.
Yeah.
The same way, I can tempt because the things that tempt characters are not the same things that tempt players, and it's very easy for the player to resist what should be a great struggle for the character. By throwing in that mechanical backing, you make it tempting for the player as well.
Yeah, that's one thing I always liked about the compels in Fate, is how it encourages players to role play their character a bit more.
The first episode that we played was pretty straightforward. It was one character played a Rahu who changed the night he got out of jail and found out that his girlfriend hadn't exactly waited for him. And so I had this like one cycle of the moon where all of them changed because this werewolf that was about to change was casting these waves into the spirit world that was waking them up. And as one woke up and then another, there was just more and more of this cross wake until there was just this complete turmoil in the local shadow. Now, by the second game, where they were all werewolves the whole first story is about them establishing themselves as a pack, gaining their territory, things like this. The issues of a bunch of newly changed werewolves finding their place in a new and different world. But the second one, they really took the reins on the story and took it where they wanted to go, and I was really happy to see that happen. There were a lot of index cards flying in the middle of the table. It wasn't just all missions that I threw out. They were throwing out missions and pursuing those. So it was really nice to see that it's all starting to come together and work the way I had hoped it would.
Yeah, that's nice to see. I know, I mentioned last time the trouble that I had with giving players control over the campaign. If you don't give them enough of a direction, then a lot of times they just don't do anything. And even in games where But I've been in some games where you said, okay, throw out whatever quest ideas, and nobody even comes up with anything other than what's already on the main quest arc that we started on, just because, you know, I don't even know what it is. It's hard to come up with our own quest ideas outside of what we're already doing.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with warm-up games, which we'll talk about in our next episode as our main discussion topic. But yeah, how they're sometimes eliciting creative input is something more subtle than just saying, hey, tell me what you want. You need to find some ways to go at it sideways
Well, yeah, that's the problem, is a lot of times players don't even know what they want until they're already doing it.
Yep.
So
this is a local campaign I've been running, and that's what I really got excited about, was taking a game to explore local history and folklore and traditions and how that resonates, especially with the idea in Werewolf the Forsaken of the spirit world or the shadow, where the things that happen take on this mythic, poetic resonance. And also looking at some of the things that we know and recognize and making them look a little bit different. Yeah. Like the part that you really got excited about when I told you was there's a host of characters of homeless people in Oakland.
Yeah, this is really cool.
And me and Mike both went to the University of Pittsburgh, so we had some familiarity with these dramatis personae. And one that really always impressed us was this guy who would wander around Schenley Park. Huge beard, right?
Mm-hmm.
Huge beard covers his chest. And we'd always see him in the summer walking around shirtless. And there were these two big dogs with him. Now,
they're like wolves, man.
Yes. And they're, like, I know people who have these little yappy dogs that I'm, like, nervous around, because I know they have absolutely no control over this dog, and the dog will jump up on me, and I get nervous around dogs because I can't, animals in general, really, because I can't read their intentions, and they have teeth and claws, and they might hurt me. Whereas I'm usually fairly confident that most people I cross paths with will not bite me. I'm not that confident about cats or dogs or things like that. So, and yet I've never felt nervous around this guy.
And it's important to keep in mind here too that these dogs aren't on leashes or anything.
No leashes.
They just follow him around.
Yes, but he has such complete control over them without ever touching them, without a leash. I've never felt nervous at all around this guy. And we've joked that he is in fact God and commands the whole world as completely as he commands these dogs. So when I was thinking of what werewolf packs in Pittsburgh there might be, I remembered this guy. And in my game, this is a Hunter in Darkness pack. There's the one guy who walks around in human form, and there's the two others that follow him in wolf form, and they patrol Schenley Park. And they're in Werewolf the Forsaken packs have spirits that serve as their totems. The totem of his pack is Panther in the Hollow, the spirit of the panthers that used to live in Panther Hollow.
Nice. Yeah, and I thought that was just really cool. And I think we're planning on doing an episode about locally based campaigns later on, so I won't get into it too much, but it does say, like, even in the World of Darkness core book, they talk about setting your game in the town where you are, and, like, that weird guy at the convenience store down the street could be, like, a vampire.
Right when we were starting the campaign, I had two of the players comment on how this locally based campaign might be hard to pull off because this is Pittsburgh and nothing interesting ever happens here.
Well, I mean, if you were playing Mutants and Masterminds, that might be an issue. But for something like World of Darkness, where it's all about, like, that secret world that goes on behind the scenes, I think it works.
Actually, I'd love to see a Mutants and Masterminds campaign set in Pittsburgh. That'd be awesome. But, like, one of the things I really want to accomplish with role-playing games is using them to build a sense of place, so that when you walk away from the table, you've had a fun night, you've told a story, and you have, at the end of the night, this story that brings you to a sense of place and gives you this sense of story and depth of where you live. And I want to take people, I think that people all too often look to other places as the interesting places. We look to New York or LA and say that's where the interesting things happen. And we denigrate the interesting things about the places where we live.
The grass is always greener.
Yeah. And we, but we need to, I think one of the fundamental things that we need to do as humans in the world today is appreciate the places where we live and build roots into that place and understand the depth and history and how much there is that's interesting and captivating in your own backyard. And I think RPGs can do a lot to do that if you run a bunch of local campaigns that are really weaving that in. I cannot tell you how much it warmed my heart when after playing that Fifth World game, you went down to Station Square and you told me that you were walking under the bridge and thought, wow, this is where the hermit will have his hut in 400 years, yeah, ferrying pilgrims to the land of the dead.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
The very fact that you had that experience after playing the game was a validation of everything I've been trying to do with locally based campaigns for years now. And that's why one of the reasons I've been wanting to play this werewolf game for so long. And it's off to a good start, and I hope to talk more about some of the things I've done with it in later sessions of this play review segment. For today's response segment, we don't have an email or a voicemail exactly, but John Scheib, you'll remember he joined us for our old school episode.
Right.
He wrote and asked us about how we handle problem players.
Yeah, how do we handle problem players?
Well, I think first is dispensing with the notion that there's such a thing as problem players.
Yeah, I guess you just describe them as problem people.
Well, no, it's not that there is no such thing as problem people. There's no such thing as problem players. I do not believe in problem players. I believe in miscommunication. I believe in different agendas, different creative agendas, different values, different things we want to get out of play, different sockets, if you will. But I don't believe in problem players. The same person who is a problem at my table may be great at your table. And it's a matter of figuring out which games people enjoy why.
That's where the problem part comes in, though.
Right. Exactly. But it's not that this person is problematic. The problem is the relationship, not the person. The problem is that this person is at your table and really probably should be at a different table.
Yeah, but then there's still the question of, well, what do you do with that person?
Well, if you...
Because, you know, nobody is a perfect communicator.
Right.
There's going to be misunderstandings along the way.
Yeah.
So, what do you do when this problem crops up in your game?
Well, I think the first thing you need to do is recognize that it's that relationship and not the person. Because all too often, it becomes that this is a problem player, that he is a problem player, that this person is the problem, and now it has this accusatory tone, the person gets defensive, and you get into this whole big mess. By recognizing it up front from the beginning as a problem of a relationship and not of a person, that this person is a perfectly good player in a specific game, that avoids a whole big problem right there, because now you've changed the entire tone of the discussion from how do we solve this problem of this player to how do we put this player at a game where he's going to enjoy and that he's going to be good at.
Yeah, I mean, even if it reaches the point where you have to ask this player to leave, you know, I don't think you have to be a jerk about it. I think for most people, you can say to the guy, look, we're playing this particular type of game. It doesn't seem to be the type of game that you wanted it to be, and you might be better off finding another group to play with. That's fine. And
yeah,
it's not like a personal accusation. It's just, you know, you might be happier with a different gaming group.
And we have a session quite a few weeks from now scheduled out for like roles lawyer, which is usually considered a type of problem player. And I don't want to dig too much into what we have planned out for a future episode already.
I don't actually, I consider having a roles lawyer a benefit.
It certainly can be. But the type who is trying to use the roles to break the game, it very often becomes a problem.
To work the system.
Yeah.
Like Red Mage style.
Yeah. And I think that that is a behavior that emerges, frankly, I said before, we wanted to talk about GM-less games, because I see this as a problem that pervades a lot of other discussions. I see that as a player who doesn't have autonomy in the story trying to exert autonomy where he has it, which is in the rules. So you cling to those rules because that's where you can have some autonomy and some expression in the game, and so you just kind of obsess over that. And the problem there that I would see is not that this person is a problem player, not that he's breaking your game, but that this player feels stifled ultimately, and you need to give this player more ways of expressing himself in the story so that he won't feel that the rules are the only thing that he can express himself in.
Yeah, that's the other thing, is before you even talk about asking the player to leave, depending on what the particular issue is with that player, you know, it may not be that he's a quote-unquote problem player. It may just be that, you know, his particular play style is going unused in the game. And so you can think about ways, well, how do I bring this player in more in a way that he'll appreciate the campaign better? And if you look at the Dungeon Master Guide 2 for Dungeons & Dragons 4th Edition, they have a whole section about different types of players and how to bring them into the game.
Yeah, I threw out a little quiz. I don't think most of the people recognized the questions that I was sending out, but I just sent out, like, here's a bunch of statements, tell me how much you agree with them. And then I scored those to get, and the statements were from the DMG with these 8 different types of players and statements that characterize them. So once I had people saying how much they agree or disagree with those, I was able to rank how much each of my players resonated with these archetypes that WotC had identified.
Yeah, as it turns out, I am actually a bit of an instigator.
Yep.
Which, yeah, that sounds about right.
Yep.
but, you know, even with the instigator, it doesn't say, you know, kick this guy out of the game because he's a troublemaker. You know, you give him more obstacles to overcome. You give him more to explore so that, you know, he likes testing the boundaries of what he can do in the game, so let him run with that.
Yeah. I think the rules lawyer is one specific example, but I think that in general that covers a lot of the quote-unquote problem players that a lot of role players will identify. And I think that a lot of the time it comes from players who feel locked out of the game, acting out because they don't know how else to engage the game because they feel that they've been locked out of everything else.
Yeah.
So even before you start the discussion of what game this person would prefer, I think you need to look at your own self. If you're GMing this game and you're saying, oh, I have this problem player, or even if you're another player at the table and you're saying, oh, there's this problem player, I think you need to look at what it is that this person's not getting out of the game that makes them act out this way. And is that something that you could change enough to provide? Sometimes what they want is something that is so far away from what everybody else wants that they just need to find a different game where they will be getting that. But if it is something that you can accommodate, if it's something that's close enough to what everybody else is after, that you can just throw in more of that, then that's how you solve problem players. You give them what they want, what it is that they're after, that they're not getting.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, the job of the GM is, you know, it shouldn't just be the GM telling his own story. It's you're there to entertain everybody at the table, so.
And if it's a GM-less game, then that means that all of you should be working on what everybody else at the table wants. There's one of the rules of improv that is very big in story jamming is make each other look good. You know, if the Hulk, you know, gets big and green and all of his clothes tear off because of the huge muscles, and oh my God, he's so huge, and then he punches a car and the car does nothing, like the car just stands there. Hulk looks like a jerk. Yeah. He looks like an idiot.
Yeah.
If he punches the car and the car smashes to 1,000 pieces and glass and steel are flying everywhere, like, oh my God, the Hulk is so strong. What sold the Hulk as strong is not him being huge and green and muscle bound. It was the reaction of the car smashing into 1,000 pieces. Same way, in the 4E campaign that Mike's been running, his Eberron campaign, my bard does not look suave and charismatic and persuasive when he says something clever. He looks suave and persuasive and charismatic when other people respond to him that way. And there's nothing I can do that it's going to sell him as charismatic. It's what other people do that's going to sell him as charismatic. So if you're sitting at the table, and this applies whether there's a GM or it's a GM-less game. If it's a GM-less game, it counts twice as much. But I cannot make my bard look cool. I can make everybody else at the table look cool. If I'm focusing on making my bard look cool, there's one person at the table making me look cool. If there's three other people at the table making me look cool, then I'm going to come off much better, and they can actually do it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's actually a lot of lessons from improv that RPG players can learn from.
Absolutely.
I think that's one in particular that I don't think RPG players take to heart enough.
Yeah.
Is, you know, it seems a lot of times when we play, everybody is really focused on making their own character look cool.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like you say, really should be everybody at the table trying to make everybody else at the table look cool.
Yeah, and put another spin on that that's more relevant to what we were just talking about. Don't come to the table trying to make it fun for you. Come to the, whether it's a GM's game or a GM-less game, whether you're the GM or just or another player, come to the table to make it fun for everybody else. And trust that they're going to come to the table and make it fun for you.
Yeah.
Take that. If everybody at the table is cool with that, and that's what they're there for, and they have that in mind when they sit down, I think you're going to see 9 out of 10 problem players, quote-unquote, all those problems go away.
Yeah. If it still turns out that the person just isn't having fun, then, you know, there shouldn't be a sense of obligation where, you know, I have to play this game because all of my friends are playing. If you feel the person isn't really enjoying the game as much as everybody else is, then, you know, there's really no reason for that person to stick around either.
Gamer group promiscuity is great. Gaming groups are not marriages. You can
yeah.
You can go game around.
Yeah. So, you know, and presumably you're playing with people that you know and you're generally friendly with. So you should be able to talk to your players about what their expectations are in terms of what they want to get out of the game.
Well, that will just about do it for this episode. We talked about the Story Jammer's journey and how story jamming has some things in common with Campbell's Hero's Journey, Van Gennep's Rites of Passage, and the traditions of hunting among the Yukagirs in southern Russia. I talked a little bit about the werewolf game that I've started playing, and we'll probably be talking a lot more about that as different issues arise in play. But RPGs can do a lot of things for building a sense of place and weaving stories into your local environment. Finally, problem players do not exist. There's only problematic gaming relationships, and understanding that can help ease some of the tensions you might have at the gaming table anytime you feel tempted to use that phrase, problem player.
We need, like, a player marriage counselor that people can go to.
Right. If you'd like to send us an email for our response segment, you can email us at response@storyjammers.com, or you can leave us a voicemail message at 646-462-4161, extension 83650. Or you can visit us at storyjammers.com, where you can comment on this or any of our previous episodes. The music you're listening to is from Robin Stein's album Daydream, available through Magnatune. This podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. Thanks for listening.